May it please the court. My name is Rick Carmichael, registration number 20742. I'm with Irwin and Boson, and with me at council table today is Brad Irwin, together on behalf of the appellants. The airport in Grand Junction is a controlled airport manned by air traffic controllers whose responsibility is to manage the flight, the safety of flight. At this time of this flight, the air traffic controller was an employee of Serco. Serco is contracted by the FAA to manage the airport. In July 2005, Jim Harris was a passenger on a plane that crashed at the airport in Grand Junction. When that plane crashed, he was severely injured, caused him to become a paraplegic. The plane was also completely destroyed. The FAA's orders require that whenever there is an aircraft accident defined as an injury to a person within the hospital for 48 hours or more, or broken bones, or where the aircraft itself is destroyed, when there's an aircraft accident, there has to be a report taken, and there has to be a retention of the audio recordings between the air traffic controller and the pilot. At this facility, there was a recording. It's initially recorded on an expensive tape, but the station manager there transferred that tape to a cheap 33-cent cassette tape and retained it for 45 days. But on the 46th day, he destroyed it. The Harrises asked that an adverse inference instruction be given at the trial court. There are two arguments advanced for this adverse inference instruction. The first is based on the spoliation law in Colorado. In Colorado, a party is required to maintain evidence when it's reasonably foreseeable at litigation. The Alloy case and other cases make this point. There's a second reason, and that's the FAA order 8020.11, which requires Serco in this case to maintain this evidence for at least 2.5 years if it's an aircraft incident, and 5 years when it's an aircraft accident. Central to Serco's defense in this case is it was not required to keep the tapes and the evidence, but instead was required to destroy it. Was there an FAA order that required Serco to destroy the tape? The answer is no. At trial, prior to trial, the hearings there, and in the briefs, I pointed out repeatedly that there is no order in the FAA to require that this evidence be destroyed. Serco in his brief says, Serco destroyed the evidence in compliance with FAA data retention requirements. But they cited no place in the orders which required them to destroy that evidence.
I don't understand Serco to be saying on appeal that in fact there was a requirement that they destroy it. Nor did I find that in the opinion of the trial court. Would you comment on that?
What Serco said was they destroyed the evidence in compliance with FAA data retention requirements. I understand that to mean their argument is that they were required to destroy it after 45 days. The retention requirements require them to keep that tape for 45 days. If it's a non-incident, if it's a nothing, is essentially how they described it. A mishap is how the air traffic controller described it to the FAA on the night of the flight when it crashed. He called and described it as a mishap, not advising them of the nature of the injuries and the destruction of the aircraft. Had he advised them as such, the FAA orders require them to keep it for at least 2.5 years.
But didn't the court find that Serco's conduct was not in bad faith, and isn't that a crucial element of the spoliation doctrine?
No, it's not, Your Honor. My understanding of the Alloy case is that bad faith is not a requirement, only that it be relevant. My understanding of that case is that there is no requirement that we show bad faith on their part, only that they destroy evidence that was reasonably foreseeable in litigation.
All right, well, let's get to reasonably foreseeable. It took several years for a lawsuit to be filed. So at the time it was destroyed, which I think you said was 46 days after the incident, other than the fact that there had been an airplane crash, how could they have foreseen at that point that there would be a lawsuit against them?
I think it was foreseeable it could be a lawsuit against them. The controller in this case was advising the pilot of the wind conditions. The tape was destroyed after 45 days, should have been retained. I think when you have an aircraft that crashes on the tarmac there, and you have two individuals that are taken out by emergency vehicles, one of which spent 63 days in the hospital and leaves the hospital as a paraplegic, there's good reason to believe that litigation is reasonably foreseeable, first against somebody, maybe one of the passengers against the plane, the pilot owner, But at least also against Serco, there's no reason to have you destroy this evidence. It could have been retained, and I think it was foreseeable that litigation would ensue, even if not against them. And I don't think the case is required that litigation be against them.
That was my question, because the trial court seems to have distinguished between reasonably foreseeable that somebody was going to get sued and reasonably foreseeable that Serco was going to get sued. What's the requirement? Can it just be reasonably foreseeable that there's going to be some litigation?
The cases, I don't think, really distinguish that and make that point clearer than that. I do think, though, that when it's reasonably foreseeable that litigation will ensue, and that's what the Aloy case discusses, and the Chief case, I think that Serco has a duty to keep it, even if they themselves don't know that they might be a target of a lawsuit. But I think beyond that, in this case, Serco should have expected that they would be a target in this lawsuit, in a lawsuit. When he's controlling a plane that crashes on a tarmac like that, in the wind conditions that was prevailing that day, I think that there's reason to believe that the tower could be responsible for that.
But what do we do with the fact findings of the trial judge that the destruction did not occur at a time when there was any pending or reasonably foreseeable litigation, and that it was not a willful destruction?
First, again, with the willful, I don't think willful is required, but I think it was willful. They did destroy it knowing what had happened on the tarmac. The trial court, when the court considered this, missed the point. They destroyed the tape after 45 days. No, there was no pending litigation. Mr. Harris was still in the hospital on the day this tape was destroyed. He retained counsel at the end of his stay in the hospital, and 7 days after he was released from the hospital, a letter was sent to the FAA requesting that the tape be produced. The FAA didn't have it. Instead, Serco had it. The FAA advised us that they didn't have it. It was retained by the tower at Grand Junction. On October 17th, which is just 2 months after the crash, we did send a letter to Serco. It wasn't until February that they returned a response saying that we don't have it any longer. So as quickly as we could, as quickly as you can expect, the paraplegic in the hospital to notify Serco that we wanted that cassette tape, I think Mr. Harris complied with that. And I think that's the point of spoliation law, that a party who has evidence keeps that evidence until a reasonable time passes. In this case, Mr. Harris didn't have a reasonable opportunity while receiving treatment in the hospital at Grand Junction to request a tape. But the point of spoliation law is to preserve the rights of all the parties, of all the evidence.
To follow up on Judge Kopelke's question, a trial court's finding that something is reasonably foreseeable, is that a finding of fact or a conclusion of law or a mixed question of law and fact, or what is that?
I would think that would be perhaps a mixed finding between the two. He's got to know the facts that are applicable there, but the reasonableness of the anticipated reasonable foreseeable litigation, I think, has a legal element as well.
Yeah, because it matters, of course, for our standard of review.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Yeah.
So the FAA order 8020.1 required this tape to be kept for at least 2.5 years. Serco has advanced no legal argument. Legal argument being pursuant to the FAA order that controlled this flight, that controlled the operations of Serco at this airport, they advanced no legal argument in their briefs that explained why this should be kept. Now, they did mention the 3 years, that the lawsuit wasn't filed for 3 years. That has something to do with their cross appeal. But again, concerning that, Mr. Harris requested that tape as reasonably quickly as he possibly could. Another issue is whether or not all of this is harmless nonetheless. Serco argues that this is harmless, but I don't, first of all, believe that that's the point. The question is, first, the content of the evidence that destroyed. Mr. Harris has no idea what was on that tape. He recalls only that the winds were advised to be calm, like a variable, his testimony. Mr. Lowe died before he could be deposed in our litigation. In prior litigation, he was deposed, but many of the questions that would have been asked of him weren't asked because the litigation had a different slant to it and concerned the destruction of the aircraft. When he died, whatever he would have said was then lost. Relevance is the issue. The question is whether or not this evidence is relevant to an issue at trial. Had this evidence been preserved, there's no doubt
that this evidence, this tape, and what was said would have been central to all the experts, to all the testimony at trial as to what happened between the air traffic controller and his pilot. What winds were hit, was he advised of? Serco's expert, Red Henderson, Edward Henderson, was able to testify at trial on information given to him by the air traffic controller. He testified that there were three wind checks at 7 miles, 4 miles, and 2 nautical miles out. He testified that the winds were varying between 15 and 25 knots. That was not information we had access to, and in fact, in his deposition, the air traffic controller had no recollection of what the winds were or what he advised. Simply that, I think they gave them three wind checks. So they were able now to cut this against us, because they had an air traffic controller that could say what was useful to them, but which we could not respond to. Mr. Harris didn't have recollection after the crash as to what was said. The ASOS was an issue at trial. The ASOS gave data that we relied upon in our theory of the case, but it's not harmless that the air traffic controller at trial agreed that he did not give the ASOS data. Their defense at trial was essentially that I told the pilot how dangerous the winds were, the direction, the speed of the winds, and the pilot nonetheless blew into those winds, landing when he shouldn't have and crashed as a result of his own fault. That tape would have conclusively shown what in fact did happen between the controller and the pilot. Serco argues that the tape would be cumulative. I think that there's no case which shows that a party who destroys evidence can then take advantage of curing the loss by offering their own self-serving testimony as to what happened when there was conclusive evidence as to what happened on that tape. At this point, if the court has any questions, I'll have to reserve the balance of my time.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Dean Neuwirth. I represent Serco Management Services, Inc. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in declining, after very careful consideration, to give an adverse inference instruction in this case. First off, the FAA order at issue 8020.11b does not stand for the proposition for which counsel characterized it. It's important to understand that Serco, as the contractor, falls within a scheme, a very comprehensive scheme that the FAA promulgates and requires the contractor to follow. And Serco comes into a situation where all the equipment at issue is placed by the FAA, its use is dictated by the FAA, the maintenance and keeping of these tapes is dictated by the FAA. When the crash occurred, contrary to what counsel represented, it was fully and immediately reported to the FAA by Serco's air traffic controller. And that is a finding of fact that Judge Bacher made, that the accident was properly reported and properly described. Serco, and this is in the record, is not qualified to conduct accident investigation, has no accident investigators. When an aircraft crashes, the investigation is conducted by the FAA in conjunction with the NTSB, Transportation Safety Board. Those people decide, based on their investigation, what the data retention requirements are going to be. What happened here was, after the accident was properly reported, and at the time of the accident, the record shows and the trial court found that Serco did not know what the injuries were to the plaintiff. I appreciate the emotional appeal to the plaintiff's injuries, but the real problem with this case, Your Honors, is that the plaintiffs are trying to hold Serco responsible for a decision made by the FAA. They should have sued the FAA. They tried to, but they messed it up. And because they failed to properly comply with the notification requirements before you can sue a federal government agency, they lost the ability to sue the FAA. That was the issue in the federal trial court's order. That's part of my cross appeal, but it's relevant here because, having lost the ability to sue the FAA, they're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole and blame Serco for a decision that only the FAA can make. And what the trial court found was that this probably should have been characterized by the FAA as an accident, as counsel described it, and the data the FAA probably should have required Serco to retain the data. But the FAA did not do that. What the FAA said to Serco when Serco reported the accident was, hold it on the normal 45-day cycle. And then the FAA never got back to Serco. And the undisputed testimony about how this regulatory scheme functions in practice, in custom and practice, is that if the contractor does not hear back from the FAA, then the material is destroyed. The data is not retained. You revert back to the presumptive 45-day cycle.
There's no requirement to destroy the data, though.
There is no requirement to destroy the data, and Serco conceded that, and we have never argued that there was a requirement to destroy the data. The trial judge probed very carefully, Your Honor, into that exact point through some very pointed questioning of Serco's representative, who conceded that there was no requirement that it be destroyed. But the flip side was there was no requirement that it be kept, and that it was reasonable to interpret the FAA order to mean that if we say hold it for 45 days, then once you get to day 46, if you don't hear from us, you don't need to hold it anymore. And when you look at the cases that deal with spoliation, I'm going to look at my outline just to make sure that I get this right. The Western case, which is a post-alloy case that we cited in our briefs, says that it was not an abuse of discretion not to give an adverse inference instruction, same situation here, where the trial court credited the spoliator's testimony that the evidence was destroyed for a reason besides litigation, or the reasonably foreseeable litigation. What happened here was Serco's representative provided the trial court with a very credible and reasonable explanation for why this evidence was destroyed that was completely irrelevant to the litigation that ultimately ensued. The trial court credited that testimony and held that Serco's understanding of how the order worked was a reasonable one. And so under the case law, it's not an abuse of discretion not to give an adverse inference instruction under those circumstances. Now, I'd like to just step back a minute and get into the Colorado case law. The Alloy case, which I see as the salient case now in this area, the 2006 Colorado Supreme Court case, says that when you're reviewing this issue, whether a trial court abused its discretion in giving or not giving an adverse inference instruction, you go look at the twin purposes of the instruction, which are punishment against the spoliator and the other party's need for remediation due to the loss of the evidence. And here, the circumstances as found by the trial court was that neither punishment nor remediation were necessary. So with respect to punishment, the Castillo case, which we cited, which is also a post-alloy case, found, again as here, no abuse of discretion in not giving an adverse inference instruction where the defendant destroyed the evidence before the defendant had an expectation of being sued. Now, the trial judge here clearly stated twice that there was no evidence that Serco had an expectation of being sued at the time that it destroyed the evidence in what it believed was reasonable compliance with the FAA procedures.
Let me stop on that point again, and let me put the same question to you that I put to opposing counsel. I'm looking at the trial court's bench ruling, and the trial court appears to have thought there was a difference. There's one situation where somebody's going to get sued, one situation where Serco has reason to know it was going to get sued. Trial court says what we have here is the former situation and not the latter. As I read this, it sounds like the trial court thought it would have been reasonable to assume that there was going to be some litigation, but the question was, should Serco have reasonably foreseen that it would be sued? First, I want to know if there is, in fact, that distinction in the case law.
I am not aware that that distinction arises in the Colorado case law, and I did think about that before coming here today. And I am not aware of a Colorado case that arises in any situation other than where the litigator was a party to the case. So if you go that route, I think you're making new law. in Colorado at least. In other words, I'm not aware of a Colorado case that sanctions a spoliator because the spoliator thought that they were destroying evidence that could be used against someone else, which would here be the FAA. And the other answer to your question, Judge Vogt, is I don't think it really matters because, again, this goes back to my point that the party to sue is the FAA, not CERCLA, because the FAA is the one that investigates the case, makes the decision not to order data retention, no formal package for 5 years, no informal package for 2.5 years. The inference here is that the accident, we know the accident was investigated. It's in the record. Somebody from the NTSB visited Mr. Harris in the hospital, and the pilot Lowe submitted a comprehensive written statement to the NTSB 10 days after the accident. So we know that they had the information. We have the finding that Mr. Myers, CERCLA's air traffic controller, accurately reported what he saw and the circumstances that he was aware of to the FAA. So they investigated it and they made a decision not to retain the data. The way the system operates, and the evidence is undisputed that the way this operates is if the FAA doesn't get back to the contractor and say keep it after 45 days, then it's gone. So under those circumstances, even if, and there's no evidence to support this, but even if CERCLA had thought it was trying to protect the FAA, you can't hold CERCLA responsible for that because it's complying with it's doing what it has to do under the regulatory scheme. If you rule otherwise, what you're doing is you're having CERCLA substitute its judgment for the FAA. So you could have a situation where the air traffic control investigation system gets a very bollocks up because the FAA says, we found that this was pilot error or that this was just due to an act of God and the data doesn't need to be kept. But then the controllers are saying, well, we don't know, we might get sued and some court might find that we're spoliators or even if we don't get sued, a court may find that we're spoliators, so we're just going to hang on to this. And the FAA says, no, you can't do that. We're telling you to get rid of it. And it could be a big problem for the system. So I think that's the answer to that question. What I'm trying to get at here is that there's no basis in the record to show that the punitive function of the doctrine of adverse inferences would be furthered here by giving an adverse inference instruction. Whether it's a question of fact or a mixed question of law and fact, and I think it's a question of fact, we know that CERCLA did not reasonably expect to be sued. And it had an innocent explanation for why it destroyed the evidence. Whether the evidence should have been destroyed or not is not really the question. The question is whether there's an innocent reason why the evidence was destroyed. Since there was, there's no reason to punish CERCLA. And if you punish it, you're punishing the wrong party. With respect to the remediation aspect of the Alloy case, I disagree with counsel's characterization of the record. There was lots of other evidence at the trial of what the tape would have shown. There were three people who heard the conversation. Mr. Myers, he gave his best recollection. He was deposed on it. Mr. Lowe, the pilot, fortunately was deposed in this other case before he died, and he gave what I believe is a complete recollection of that conversation. He also, in his report to the NTSB, gave a complete recollection of the conversation. The jury heard and saw all that evidence. Mr. Harris, the plaintiff himself, if you look at his testimony, had an extremely detailed recollection of the conversation, and he also provided a very detailed statement to the NTSB, which also came into evidence as Exhibit Triple L. So the jury had this information through other sources. There's a case that the trial judge cited, People v. XREL AEL 181 P3rd 1186, where at 1196-7, the court held that, again, no abuse of discretion in declining to give an adverse inference instruction where other evidence at the trial made the same point that the adverse inference would have made. And in fact, here, Mr. Myers made a key admission against CERCLA's interest at the trial. The sole theory of liability of negligence against Serco here was that Mr. Meyer should have given Pilot Lowe the data from this ASOS machine. He didn't do it, but he should have. That was their theory. He gets on the stand and he testifies, I didn't do it. I didn't give him that data. That's direct evidence. That, and direct evidence is better than an inference. That's the same direct evidence that they wanted the inference to show. So all that's left is that point is for the plaintiffs to prove or have the jury accept the fact that the data should have been given, and the jury rejected that issue. So that's why this whole question of whether the inference instruction should have been given goes away once you get later into the trial. And then I heard a new argument out of counsel today, an argument that they were hampered in cross-examining one of our experts, Mr. Henderson, because they didn't have the tape. That's a new argument. It's not, I haven't heard it before. You can't consider it now. They weren't hampered. There was no surprise here at any point. Everybody was deposed. Everybody gave their best recollection. There's nothing, there would have been nothing on the tape that was relevant to any disputed issue at the trial. The disputed issue was the ASOS data. So there's no need for remediation, no need for punishment. Therefore, there's no abuse of discretion by the trial court in declining to give the instruction. And I'd add, just to reiterate, because we are under the abuse of discretion standard, even if any of you sitting as the trial court might have ruled another way, that's not your role here under an abuse of discretion standard. The trial judge looked very carefully at this. He didn't rule on it on the papers. He said, I want an evidentiary hearing. When the hearing was held, he questioned Serco's representative very closely, got some concessions out of him, made a very thoughtful and reasoned decision nonetheless that dovetails with the case law. And under those circumstances, there's nothing here that's an abuse of discretion. If I could just make one quick point on the cross appeal, I'm about out of time. Unless the court has any other questions, I would ask to affirm.
Is your cross appeal moot if the judgment is affirmed?
It is, Your Honor.
So it's conditional cross appeal?
Yes.
All right. It wasn't in the brief, so I wasn't clear.
I didn't expressly say that. I wasn't sure how you like to handle that, but that is correct. Thank you.
Opposing counsel indicates that the FAA, that the judge determined that the air traffic controller did accurately, completely, fully report this to the FAA. In fact, what Myers testified to was that he reported a mishap. The FAA heard a mishap, according to the air traffic controller. With that information, they had no knowledge of the plane crash on the runway or the injuries. Mr. Meyer, the air traffic controller, stood from the tower and could see on the runway as he called emergency vehicles himself to come out and recover the aircraft from the runway and extract the bodies from the airplane, the individuals from the airplane. There's no reason to believe that he did not know this was an aircraft accident. If the FAA did not explicitly order them to retain the tapes, it's only because the air traffic controller did not fully and accurately report it.
But counsel, I'm confused. I thought there was an investigation, so they knew there was an accident.
The NTSB, separate from the FAA, the NTSB did send somebody to the hospital where interviews were done, but that information was by the NTSB and not communicated back to the FAA, which my understanding is controls the operation of Serco at the tower. Again, counsel indicates that Serco did not know of the injury. I think there's every good reason to believe that Serco, in fact, did know of the injury. Again, there's no FAA order that orders you to destroy it, and counsel just acknowledged that at trial they acknowledged that, but nevertheless, it seems their argument seems to perpetuate the idea that they had no other choice but to destroy this evidence. In fact, they could have retained it. There's no reason for it to be destroyed. If retention would have solved all of these problems at trial, there would have been little dispute over what was said had this tape been kept. There's the issue of the third-party spoliation. As far as that goes, I think even if the trial court found or did not find that Serco here itself should have known that it could have been sued, I think the fact that it was sued brings to light that it should have expected that somebody might be sued, including itself. But in this case, Serco should have kept it. The issue of the punitive versus remedial,
In this case, I think that instruction, an adverse inference instruction, would have been remedial. It would have explained to the jury that there was evidence of recording here. The jury listens to the trial and hears nothing of recording that they know must exist, that they reasonably expect does exist. And I think that works to plaintiff's disadvantage. Counsel didn't argue his own appeal, but just a few seconds on that. He explains that I didn't deal with the Hood case. The Hood case is a 1971 Delaware case that has no applicability here. The facts don't parallel. They don't match at all. There's nothing in the Hood case that matters. The remedial statute that's at issue there, I think, the only argument he comes up with is on the notice of appeal. But the notice of appeal issue in Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 4A, Section 5 and 6, itself has its own mechanism for tolling the notice of appeal. And the remedial statute itself has no such mechanism which limits it, and so I think the 60B applies there. Therefore, I ask the court to overturn the district court's judgment and reinstate the case and have the court issue an adverse inference instruction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today.